Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Evangelical Christianity is on the brink of social collapse. Pious Christians are more likely to get divorced than their non-church-going counterparts. Evangelicals are largely poor, white, uneducated individuals who are easily controlled and largely motivated by their fear of and hatred toward other groups they find different. Practicing Christians tend to be stingy when it comes to helping others, rarely hew to their ethical standards that they promote, and of course, they all have big hair. And when it comes to ranking their respect for different groups in society, only prostitutes rank lower than evangelicals in the mind of the general public. If you pay attention at all to the media, be it the news, Hollywood movies, or even Christian trade publications, you have probably encountered various statements such as these. But are they really true? To give us insight into these stereotypical notions of Christians, I am joined today by Bradley R. E. Wright, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Connecticut, or UConn, and author of the new book, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites, and Other Lies You've Been Told, A Sociologist Shatters Myths from the Secular and Christian Media, published by Bethany House. Brad, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you, Tony. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Before we get started here, I have a personal question to ask, and one that you might not expect. You go by the name Bradley R.E. Wright. What does the R.E. stand for?
Well, I have two middle names. The first is Richard, and that's the one I was born with, mm-hmm. and the second is Entner, E-N-T-N-E-R. It was my wife's maiden name before we got married, and so I took her maiden name as my middle name.
Okay, the reason I'm asking is that I'm assuming there's a lot of Brad Wrights out there in the universe, and I actually knew one growing up in my neighborhood in Wisconsin. He moved to California in the fifth grade, and you graduated from with a bachelor's from UC Davis, is that correct?
I did.
Yeah, you aren't that Brad Wright, are you?
I might be.
You might
but
be?
But I don't think so.
Okay.
I grew up in California, not Wisconsin, but... You know, maybe it's a repressed memory.
Oh, okay, maybe, because I think the last memory I have of Brad Wright was that he pushed me into a culvert that was filled with ice-filled water and snow. So, but
I've always felt bad about that, Tony. I'm sorry.
All right, we'll have to deal with that later. Let's talk about your book now, Christians Are Hate-Filled Hypocrites and Other Lies You've Been Told, which we're going to put a link to on our website. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I had a chance to read through this rather quickly. It's a really, really well-written and funny book that examines a litany of Christian stereotypes. But the other thing I find very fascinating about it is that it provides a great lesson on how statistics are used and abused by various groups in society. I have to ask, what possessed you to write this book, since it's not a common academic article or book?
No, it's not. And when I got tenure, about 3-4 years ago, I started thinking about what could I do with my research that would have reach beyond academic journals. And so I started writing a blog, just about whatever came to mind, and so I could sort of test drive different ideas. And I did an analysis of divorce statistics, which I think we'll talk about later, mm-hmm. and Christians. And I found that contrary to sort of public opinion, Christians have lower divorce rates than people who are not affiliated with religion. And that got so much feedback, positive feedback, that I started thinking, well, what are some of the other myths? Mm-hmm. And sort of one thing led to another, and then Andy McGuire at Bethany House contacted me by virtue of my blog and asked if I'd be willing to write sort of a book-length treatment on this issue.
Oh, that's great. I mean, that's actually kind of nice to hear that some people are out in the regular publishing houses and media that are contacting scholars to actually write stuff for them. It hasn't happened to me yet, but you know, maybe it will. Let's go ahead and begin with the book, and I understand why Bethany Publications or Bethany House would be interested in your book, because again, it's written very well. It really connects some interesting puzzles that drag the reader into the book. And you begin your book with
an interesting observation gleaned from a national opinion survey. It's a notion that the public's perception of evangelicals is largely no better than that of prostitutes. Now, where did this statistic come from, and what's wrong with it, if anything?
Well, there was a survey by George Barna of the Barna Research Group in 2002. And he surveyed 270 non-Christians, and he asked them what were their impressions of 11 different groups. And they included military officers, ministers, born-again Christians, Democrats, real estate agents, actors, lawyers, Republicans, lesbians, evangelicals, and prostitutes. And the results that they got back showed some variation in favorability ratings. But what's interesting about the study is not the actual findings, but how excited people got about it, because evangelicals ranked last in that list with only 22% of the 270 people reacting favorably to evangelicals, with prostitutes being the only group lower at 9%.
Mm-hmm.
And so that spawned a whole series of articles of something like... only prostitutes seen more less favorably than evangelicals or something like that.
Right. Well, what's interesting about the data, and I'm looking at the chart in front of me here, military officers scored the most favorable.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before the Rolling Stone article of General McChrystal. but ministers scored very favorable as well at 44%. Born-again Christians at 32%. And then evangelicals came well down the line. And, I mean, when I think of evangelicals, I oftentimes think of born-again Christians. So it's interesting that they separated those two out. And why did the survey do this? Do you know?
Not for any good reason that I could think of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong about asking about evangelical Christians and born-again Christians separately. But the fact that they got such different findings, for me, is a red light or a warning. George Barna makes... He has a fairly complex, I think, 9-point theological test to separate evangelicals from other types of Christians.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you answer 3 questions correctly, you're born again. And if you ask another 6, you're evangelical. So in his mind, there's a lot of difference between those groups.
Mm-hmm.
But in common usage, there aren't many people who can accurately describe the difference between the two.
Right.
I'd also like to point out that he asked about evangelicals rather than evangelical Christians. So my guess is that a lot of respondents thought that he meant evangelists, you know, the people who come to your door when you're trying to have dinner and knock on it and want to talk to you about their faith.
Or the people in polyester on the television set.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And so that's what they might be picking up here?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as you'll notice on the table, a high number of respondents did not know what evangelicals were.
Mm.
And so we actually have problems with the denominator in that statistic, because if 22% of the respondents had no idea what an evangelical was, then the 22% favorability rating is that of... that's the numerator. The denominator includes a lot of people who don't know what evangelicals are, so we wouldn't expect them to have favorability ratings.
Right.
So really, Tony, this is a statistic... Or this was a little article that if I had a master's student give it to me as a student paper for a class,
mm-hmm.
I would say, there might be something interesting here, but they're glaring methodological errors, so why don't you clean it up and come back?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it got a lot of press, and it defined a lot of how people think, non-Christians think about evangelicals. And in fact, a best-selling book was written on the basis of the survey.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, and what's nice about your book is that you not only try to clarify some of these errors, but you talk about, you know, what happens once these notions get out into the public, and they can have a relatively pernicious effect on various groups, can they not?
Yes, they can, and that's the frustration as a fellow academic, is that there's a lot of good knowledge about religion and Christianity in the United States in the academic journals. But for some reason, it just doesn't get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of the public discourse about Christianity in America is guided by Barna and a couple other groups who are providing data that I think are of lower quality than are routinely available in our journals.
And yeah, I think part of this relates to the fact that the media love a splashy, controversial story that might, you know, dredge up counterintuitive images of a certain type of group in that regard. And again, I mean, one of the reasons, as you mentioned, that it's frustrating for scholars, one of the reasons we're doing this podcast series and have created this is to try to correct a number of these things by talking with scholars such as yourself. Let me, and I'm sure people are really interested right now in terms of the title of your book, and if we just started in the first phrase of the book, Christians are hate-filled hypocrites. I mean, that's going to get some, you know, attention there to see that, and other lies that you've been told. It finishes off that statement. It leads us to this image of Christians being hate-filled hypocrites, and you cite Michael Horton, who is a theologian and a syndicated talk show host, as saying, evangelical Christians are as likely to embrace lifestyles as hedonistic, materialistic, self-centered, and sexually immoral as the world in general. Now, you looked into that, and what'd you find?
Well, evangelical Christians, on many measures of morality, follow their principles much more, follow Christian principles much more so than do religiously unaffiliated people. Mm-hmm. In terms of following those same principles. So what I mean is that evangelical Christians are less likely to commit adultery, they're less likely to have premarital sex, they're less likely to use drugs, they're less likely to commit crime, they're more honest in everyday life. So there's a number of statistics that suggest that in that area, evangelical Christians are different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this book, and I make it very clear in the book, I don't address causality. I'm looking solely at correlation.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that people who don't do these things become more involved in religion and with evangelical Christianity.
Right.
Or it could be that evangelical Christianity disinclines people from doing these things. Or maybe both.
Right. And that's an interesting research question in and of itself. And I was just recently at a conference with economist Dan Hungerman, who actually examines that question and tries to tease out the causality. We'll probably have him on an upcoming podcast here. Let me ask you about your data, though, since we're going to be talking about a number of statistics. Are you just cherry-picking, you know, data sources here? Do you just have one survey that you're relying upon? Or where are you getting your information from?
Well, what I tried to do is to define the negative, I guess the myth about American Christianity,
mm-hmm.
and then I tried to find the best data source that addressed it. And so in that sense, I was cherry-picking. I used the General Social Survey for quite a bit. I also used some of the Pew studies,
mm-hmm.
Especially the public life studies. But for some, I had to... A couple times I had to go to relatively obscure surveys just because they were the only ones that had the questions that I thought addressed the perceptions that I was studying.
Right. And the general, for those of you who don't know what the General Social Survey is, that's a survey that's conducted roughly every 2 years since about the early 70s, late 60s?
Mm-hmm. 1972, I think.
Okay. So you're actually examining a lot of these questions from a number of different sources.
I am, at least the best sources that I could find. You know, I might have missed some, but I looked pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about the book is that you do compare a number of these different surveys to show that, yes, there are similarities between these surveys, or, you know, pointing out every so often that there are some differences here. So you find some fault here with this notion that Christians are hate-filled hypocrites, that they, you know, despite the fact that they're as hedonistic, materialistic, and self-centered and sexually immoral as Michael Horton might say, is that, you know, actually, that's not true.
Indeed. Let's take the Christian's reputation question first.
Okay.
In the book Unchristian by George Kinneman of the Barna Research Group, it came out a couple years ago, his was the book that was based on this survey.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at the survey, and he said that maybe 10 years ago, he had done a different survey of different questions, but he found that non-Christians had a much more favorable attitude toward Christians,
mm-hmm.
or especially evangelical Christians, and so it was getting worse.
Mm.
Now, as a researcher, you know that if you want to make time trend analyses, you really should have the same question at different times.
Right.
And it's sort of like being saying it's cold today, it was windy last week, so it's getting colder. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, you really need the same measure over time. So it took me a while, but I was able to find a question from the Pew Public Life Studies where they said, what's your opinion of evangelical Christians? And lo and behold, it's actually gotten substantially more favorable. Mm. It was less favorable in the 1990s than it is now, and by a fair amount. So in the 1990s, if you had asked people who did not affiliate with Christianity, what's your opinion of evangelical Christians?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 70% or so would have a negative opinion. Now it's down to the 40s.
That's a substantial, statistically significant drop.
It is.
So.
And I don't know why it happened, but my best guess is that it relates to work that Michael Hout has done about why there's been an increase in people not affiliated with Christianity. Mm-hmm. And that is because in the 80s and 90s, evangelical Christians were much more likely to affiliate with political parties.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just that Jerry Falwell preached the gospel. It's he preached the gospel and he preached the Republican Party.
Right.
And that turned off some people. So my guess is that as that has diminished, and now we have Rick Warren, who invites both political, both Republican and Democratic candidates to his church for debate, that we're losing some of the negative feelings that garnered. That's just a guess, but I think it's a reasonable guess for why things are getting better.
I think that's true, and that you know steps into my area of religion and politics quite a bit. And I know in the mid to late 1990s, a number of evangelical Christians were warning about the affiliation with a specific political party, because anytime that political party faltered, and politicians, you know, are not saints in any way, shape, or form, that image reflected off on evangelical Christians. And a number of people, I think, awoke, including Cal Thomas, who early in the 1980s was very much about taking religion and blending it with politics. But, you know, by the mid to late 90s, he stepped back from that precipice in some ways. So that's an interesting thing. Tell me about divorce rates. That's another issue that comes up. And as you mentioned on your blog, this was one of the things that prompted you to write this book and that you got most feedback about. So what do we know about evangelical Christians, Christians in generally, and divorce rates?
Well, that's perhaps the most enduring myth that I've encountered, and that is that Christians, especially evangelical Christians, get divorced at a rate as high or higher than the rest of society.
What's the basis for that myth?
Sorry?
What's the basis for that myth? Why would people think that, or why is that out there in the public forum?
You know, I did some detective work, and I actually found out why. In the 1990s, I believe, George Barna published a study where he compared evangelical Christians versus non-Christians. And he found that evangelical Christians had a slightly higher divorce rate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where it gets a little tricky. For Barna, evangelical Christian, as I mentioned earlier, is someone who agrees with 8 or 9 different theological statements. Usually, it does not include someone who's Catholic or mainline Protestant. So in that study, he labeled as non-Christian most Catholics and most mainline Protestants. Now, as a Christian, that's not something I would do. For me, Catholics are as much Christians as evangelicals. I don't say that they're non-Christians.
Right.
It turns out, however, that Catholics have relatively low divorce rates.
Mm-hmm.
And so by moving Catholics into the comparison group, by labeling them as non-Christian, you drop the non-Christian divorce rate so that it is about the same or a little bit lower than evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at major religious traditions separately,
mm-hmm.
it turns out that it's the religiously unaffiliated who have the highest divorce rates.
Mm-hmm.
And that members of different Christian religions and even non-Christian religions have significantly lower divorce rates.
Do you happen to know the numbers offhand, what the ballpark figures are in terms of divorce rates
I
among
do.
Non-affiliated?
Now, these are not age-adjusted.
Okay.
And presumably you're more likely to have had a divorce in your life the older you are.
Right.
And so I offer it with that caveat.
Okay.
But among among Christians, about 42% of all Christians have had reported a divorce or are currently separated in the most recent waves of the General Social Survey.
Mm-hmm.
That compares to 50% of the non-Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, among the non-Christians, it's substantially higher among the religiously unaffiliated. I think the high 50s or low 60s in terms of percentile.
Mm-hmm.
And then among evangelicals, it's 46%, and Catholics, 35%.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, that statistic boils down to who do you define as Christian?
Right. I guess there's some other questions I have about those statistics, too, because that, again, for me, that seems a little bit high. But I guess one of the things that you weren't able to tease out, or maybe you were, was whether somebody got a divorce before becoming a born-again Christian or not. Is that true?
Correct. That's a problem with this type of analysis, is that we're not looking at when it happened. It could be that people get divorced before they become a Christian or become active in their faith.
Mm-hmm.
But in a similar manner, it could be that someone could get divorced when they're Christian, but then leave the church.
That's true.
And so it cuts both ways.
Mm-hmm.
A much bigger effect, though, was the relationship between among Christians between divorce rates and church attendance. And it turns out that evangelical Christians who attend church weekly are much, much less likely to have been divorced than those who never attend.
Mm-hmm.
So among those who never attend, about a full 60% have had a divorce or are currently separated.
Mm-hmm.
And among those who attend on a weekly basis or more often, about 35-38%. So there's a big difference there.
And that seems consistent with a lot of other research that I've read and conducted, is that attendance figures are an indicator of how serious, in many ways, people take their faith. So to ask somebody, are you a Christian or are you an evangelical Christian, it's somewhat cheap talk to say, oh, yeah, sure, I am, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's how I was raised. But somebody who says, yes, I am, and I go every week, you could see there's much different levels of affiliation or strength of belief in that might be associated with that.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah. That's kind of an interesting fact here. Let's go ahead and talk about some of these other myths that you smash or shatter, as your book subtitle says. The Bible tells us to love one another.
Mm-hmm.
But as you note in your book, there is a strong perception among non-Christians that evangelicals are stingy hate mongers. That's the title of your book in part. What about that? And I have to read one of the epigraphs that you have on one of the chapters in your book by Richard Beck, who's a professor and a Christian psychologist. He says that Christianity has essentially become a mechanism for allowing millions of people to replace being a decent human being with something else, an endorsed spiritual substitute. Now, what was he getting at there, and what myth does that perpetuate?
Well, I think the myth is that Christians, by emphasizing sort of the spiritual aspects of their lives, doctrine and maybe involvement in the community, have focused on that rather than living out their norms or their beliefs toward other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, you know, in sort of a shorthand, the concern is that Christians, they believe but they don't do.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the hypocrisy comes in.
Exactly. And this was actually the section that I had the most difficulty with in terms of finding appropriate measures. So what I wanted to find, Tony, was some measures and surveys about that would capture Christian love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't find any that I was entirely satisfied with. The best that I could find were some measures that Robert Westnow had put on the General Social Survey a decade or two ago. And what I found is that Christians did, depending on the measure, Christians or evangelical Christians did pretty well on various measures of love. But the biggest difference, again, was with attendance, that the weekly attenders were more likely to have sort of done Christian actions than those who attended less often. So, for example, there's a question on the general social survey that asks, have you given money to the homeless or volunteered for a charity twice or more in the past year? And with both of those questions, if you compare those who, evangelical Christians who attend church regularly, weekly or more, I guess I should say, they're maybe twice as more likely to give to the homeless or to volunteer for charity than evangelical Christians who rarely attend church. So I did find some support that Christians are reasonably loving toward others on average. But the measures aren't as strong as I would have liked.
So you mentioned Christian charity here. What other types of measures or proxies did you try to find for that general category of Christian love?
Well, to start off with, I thought, you know, if nothing else, Christian love implies interacting with people or sort of with other people. And so I found a question on the Social Capital Community Study that asks, do you talk with or visit your immediate neighbor on a weekly basis? So I figured, you know, we can't really love our neighbor if we never interact with them. And overall, Protestants scored pretty high on that, higher than Catholics, higher than members of other religions, and higher than people with no religion. And among Protestants, the weekly attenders scored the highest. And then another question is, on a daily basis, do you selflessly care for others and accept people even when you think they are wrong? Now, this question is a little bit awkward, but I think what it's trying to get at is attitudes about loving. And it's from the 2002 and 2004 General Social Survey. And here, mainline Protestants score the highest, but followed by evangelicals and then Catholics in terms of selflessly caring for others and accepting people even when we think they're wrong. So in terms of sort of love actions or love attitudes, I find that Christians score reasonably high on average.
And now, do you have comparisons with unaffiliated individuals or seculars, as we might call them?
Yes, and that's the main comparison group, because, as you know, Tony, in the United States, the majority of people define themselves as Christian, and the second largest group are people who define themselves as not affiliated with any religion. And then for non-Christian religions, maybe 2% at most, or usually less, affiliate with any of the other major religions. And so those are the main comparisons I make, is between types of Christians and religiously unaffiliated people.
Let's keep probing this a little bit, this issue about Christian love. So you did issues of charity, and I'm reminded of Arthur Brooks's analysis of Christian charity. His book, Who Really Cares, came out with the conclusion that Christians or religiously affiliated people, and as you mentioned, people who show that by attending church high or attending church weekly, are more likely to be charitable and giving than people who don't do that as often. Now, one of the interesting critiques of that book, and this came during a conference that I was attending. I was serving as a discussant on an author meets critics book of Arthur's book, and somebody in the audience raised their hand and said, you know, can we really believe Brooks's results that conservative Christians are more charitable than others? Because it's pretty well known that Christians are liars when it comes to this. And and that's a somewhat flippant way of saying something a little bit more methodologically sophisticated. And this might get at the hypocrisy aspect of this, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this. But the idea here is that, you know, if you're a Christian, you have high moral standards that you need to meet. And when, you know, a survey, somebody who's doing surveys comes knocking at your door or calls you up on the telephone and they ask you these questions of, you know, have you recently given to charity? There's this internal norm that drives you to say, yes, I want to make my personal behavior consistent with my ideology, and so you have this tendency to lie a little bit more. I mean, is mm-hmm. that possible? Is that what could potentially be going on here?
That's a great question, and that's something I've wondered about in a number of different issues. So, to what extent, if Christians report themselves as acting more morally than others,
right,
or more in line with their moral beliefs, how much is it their actual behavior and attitudes, and how much of it is they want to look good, they want to look like Christians are supposed to?
Right.
That's a great question. So you have, on one hand, you have the idea that Christians might be more inclined to present themselves as more moral, mm-hmm. And so they might lie. On the other hand, however, we have a tradition of confession. And so we're a group that we're supposed to our fellow Christians, and depending on which tradition you're in, to church leaders, honestly talk about your faults.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of counterbalances it. Also, my guess, and I haven't looked at data for this, is that there's maybe more tradition, more respect for authorities in religious tradition than outside. And so in that sense, that would move us towards more accurate reporting to survey takers and other forms of authority.
Mm-hmm.
What we really need is sort of objective data about giving and then self-reported giving, and we can compare the two.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I don't know of any data like that.
Yeah,
but mm-hmm. I did find some very interesting data from the one of the national family surveys. Now, it was conducted in the late 80s, so it's getting a little bit long in the tooth here.
Mm-hmm.
But it asked both the respondent and their spouse or partner about domestic abuse.
Mm.
And what the survey finds is that people who attend church on a regular basis are substantially less likely to hit or to strike or to push or tag violently.
Mm-hmm.
Toward their partner. So this is a measure of domestic violence.
Right.
Okay. So far, so good, but we have the same problem with other measures. How do we know Christians aren't just lying?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they went and asked the partner. They said, have you been pushed? Have you been hit? Have you been bitten by your partner? And so this is a way of sort of validating the accuracy of the respondents' reports, self-reported wrongdoing, as it varies by religion.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, the partner's reports lined up with the respondent's reports. And so even when you use partner's reports,
mm-hmm.
then we find the relationship between religious involvement among Christians and less domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
So that is evidence of truth-telling in surveys. It's not conclusive, but it is evidence on that side of the scale.
Yeah, that's an interesting way about going about it. They actually asked if you bit your partner?
Let's see. I don't have the exact question with
okay.
me. But it was they itemized various things that you could do to your partner
mm-hmm.
that would represent domestic violence.
Okay. I'm just asking because we are recording this just after the July 4th break of 2010, and the movie Twilight had recently come out, and that's about vampires, and so maybe that question is a little bit different nowadays. So
yeah, I guess that would be something romantic.
I guess. that whole question of trying to figure out whether people are lying or not on surveys mm-hmm. is rather interesting. I think there's another issue that goes on here with a number of these questions, and it gets to the hypocrisy issue. I had an acquaintance of mine, I guess I would call him a friend, but this was at a prayer group that we were attending, and we were talking about this issue of Christian hypocrisy, and he had the greatest quote, and I don't know if this was his quote directly or if it comes from somewhere. I've never tried to track it down, but one of the things that he said in relation to this, he says that churches are not mausoleums of saints, but hospitals for sinners.
I like that.
And the one thing that gets at this hypocrisy question is that when we do look at some of these measures of marital abuse or drinking or other types of behavior, it might not be all that surprising that we find some people who are regular churchgoers or who have said that, yes, I'm a born-again Christian, and then ask the question, you know, do you have a drinking problem? Because it may be the case that this is where people are trying to deal with some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. The quotation that I like comes from Chuck Colson mm-hmm. on this issue, and that is, he said that Christianity doesn't claim to make people perfect. It claims to make them better.
Right.
And so if somebody's a raging jerk when they become a Christian, they'll probably always be a jerk, mm-hmm. or at least they will be for some time. If someone's an alcoholic when they become a Christian or get serious about their faith, it'll probably still be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So really the question is, in what direction are people trending rather than where are they?
Right.
Also, this is something I've gone back and forth with my editor at Bethany House, and that is, what's a hypocrite?
Mm-hmm.
And one definition would be someone who doesn't live by their moral aspirations.
Right.
So I want to love others, I want to serve God, but I fall short in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the strictest measure, and by that measure, everyone's a hypocrite, because
right.
no one who holds a moral belief can adhere to it all the time.
And it's easy for those who don't have moral beliefs that, well, they're never a hypocrite.
Right, right. What he advances, and I say this to give him credit, because I think he's right, is that hypocrisy is when you are sort of saying, I don't do something, but you actually are. So you're lying about your behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So a politician who says, no, I did not have a baby with my a documentary filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
That's hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas most of the Christians I know are pretty straightforward about their misbehavior, you know,
right.
that they're pretty honest with themselves and others about routinely doing wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think that hypocrisy isn't as big a concern.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me tell you something, Tony, and I'm sure you know this from the books you've written. I just learned with this book that authors don't get to pick the title for their books.
Oh.
It never occurred to me that I wouldn't get to pick the title. But the publisher said, here's the title we like, and, you know, I think if I had screamed and yelled loud enough, they would have backed off of it. But it's not a title I would have chosen. It's a little bit more combative than I would have preferred.
Yeah, I mean, I can see where they want to sell books with this. The publishers have interest that they want to sell books.
Exactly.
Right. What? Let me ask you this. What was the title that you wanted for your book?
Oh, if I had to pick a title, it would be something like the subtitle. You know,
mm-hmm.
the subtitle is I would have said something like, a sociologist examines myths about Christianity, American Christianity,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, you can see why I'm not in marketing.
Yeah, that's a little boring of a title.
Exactly. And what my editor explained to me is really the purpose of a title is to get someone to look at a book in a bookstore and take it off the shelves and look at the back cover.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose of a title. It's more marketing than some sort of concise summary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a little confession to make here that my two books, I actually did get to choose the title of my books, which...
Oh, really?
It might explain why they're not selling very, very well. So one of the other interesting things, this is just a side note for everybody, but this is something that I'm very proud of, that both my books have, the front covers are pictures that I actually took. So I like to...
Oh, really?
Yeah, I like to say that I'm not only a published author, but a published photographer or photographer. So I'm rather proud about that aspect. So I guess maybe my next book, I'm just going to have to hand it over to the marketing department and say, hey, you know, yeah, call it Religion, Sex, and Drugs, even though it might not be about that. So, which is, let's get back and talk about some of the other findings that you have about the book. I mean, this issue about hypocrisy, I think, is rather interesting. And the issue, too, you know, that I wanted to bring up with the issue of hypocrisy is mm-hmm. that, you know, I think some of these findings, when you know, surveys by Barna or others are conducted and they find that, oh, you know, my gosh, evangelical Christians have drinking problems, that, you know, this might be, as you say, it might be overstating the problem in part because people are in churches to deal with this issue. So there might mm-hmm. be some kind of, you know, bias in the data in that regard. I know a Christian who goes to our church, and he, you know, if you asked him, are you an alcoholic, he would stand up and say, yes, I am an alcoholic, yet he hasn't touched a drink in, you know, 20, 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's part of the 12-step process that you admit, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, so if this person ever got called up on a survey and said, are you a you know, a Christian, and you'd say, yes, check that box. Do you attend church regularly? Yes, check that box. You know, are you an alcoholic? And he would immediately check yes to that box. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one could say, well, you're obviously a hypocrite in that regard. But one of the points later on in your book, and you shatter a number of different myths here in terms of Christian evangelicals and such, but one that you dealt with, and it didn't come out so rosy for Christian evangelicals, especially white Christian evangelicals, is the issue of race. What can you tell us about that?
Well, my approach with this book, Tony, wasn't to provide good news for evangelical Christians. Mm-hmm. My approach, what I tried to do, was to take the various perceptions, find the best data that I could, and then see what the answer was. And up and through about chapter 6, I was really happy with how things were going for evangelical Christianity, because in almost every analysis, it came out better than advertised.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got to attitudes toward out-group members, and I looked at race. So among white Christians, what were their attitudes towards African-Americans?
Mm-hmm.
I looked at being gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are your attitudes towards gay people? Now, not necessarily the gay sex, which it becomes more of a moral issue, but just, you know, people who are gay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked at attitudes towards people who have different religious beliefs than you. So what do you think of an atheist if mm-hmm. you're a Christian? And Christians did poorly with this.
Mm-hmm.
Christians are more likely, on average, to have prejudicial attitudes by race and by religion and by sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And that is bad news for Christianity. Now, as a digression, this is why we have to be careful to be accurate with our data, because if we hear bad news about everything, then when real bad news comes along, we might miss it.
It's the boy who cried wolf type of problem.
Exactly. So to the extent that there is a wolf here, it has to do with our attitudes towards members of other groups.
Mm-hmm.
For example, with African Americans, there's questions that are, you know, sort of standard sociological questions about race. You know, how would you feel about a member of a different race moving into your neighborhood or marrying into your family? Or what are your general attitudes towards an African-American
mm-hmm.
or an Asian or Hispanic? And white Christians had more prejudicial attitudes than white non-Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And that's bad for us, because our religion, and I speak as a Christian myself, is one of loving people who are different.
Mm-hmm. And that you bring up an interesting point to boomerang back to what we were talking about before. The fact that you find this in the data is an indication that you are getting, you know, reasonably honest responses as well. Because again, if we go back to that issue of,
that's a good point.
You know, well, hey, you know, my Christian, you know, pastor tells me to love one another, and the question comes by, how do you love one another? They're showing, you know, indications that they might not be doing too well in some of these areas here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's
true. So in a way, the bad news validates the good news.
Yeah, I think so. I think that might be the actual case there. Now, you're talking here about the opinions of white Christians.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do, any breakdown where you look at African-American Christians or other ethnic groups and how they compare on a number of these scales or indicators?
I wanted to, but I didn't because of sample size limitations.
Yeah.
And it's probably interesting to see, I mean, because we don't know, do African-American Christians feel that way towards whites?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they feel that way towards other religions? And the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it could be done with the right data set, but it's not something that I was able to do with the data that I had. So I had to limit it to white
attitudes. And I think you also admit this early on in your book, too. That's why your primary focus is on Christianity and, you know, a little bit more specifically evangelical Christianity, because you have better sample sizes for this. You don't necessarily take a look at Jews or Muslims or other groups, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it's a sample size problem. So the general social survey of, I think the last one, had maybe around, I'm going to make numbers up here and I'm going to be embarrassed when I'm so wrong, but 1,500 respondents,
mm-hmm.
and they had maybe 3 dozen Jews, 4 dozen Jews, maybe 24 Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers aren't quite right, but that's about right,
right
in terms of magnitude. So you can see, you just can't reasonably make, you can't reasonably analyze members of other religions
mm-hmm.
From the general social survey, at least using just one or two or three ways.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to the broad issue, too, and we have about 10 minutes left here to be chatting. The issue about Christianity in general. So now you're talking about, we were talking specifically about the individual attitudes of different Christians and the like. What is happening to Christianity in general? There's been news reports, and I remember this about a year ago, a major survey came out saying that the number of unaffiliated or irreligious or non-religious people has increased dramatically over the past decade or so. And there's been statements to the effect that, Christianity is on a downhill slide, that evangelical Christianity is on the precipice, and in 10 years you will not see that many evangelical Christians anymore. Some pretty, major statements along that line. What does your evidence show? What have you found?
First of all, I too found quite a few of those statements.
Mm-hmm.
And they tend to be, my impression is that they're very overheated, overblown.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a number of studies that found a big increase in the number of religiously unaffiliated people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
From 1990 to the year 2000, it went from maybe 7% to 14%.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last decade, it's gone up maybe 1 or 2%. So now it's maybe, depending on which data set you look at, maybe 16-17% of Americans do not affiliate with a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so really, that's a story for the 1990s,
right?
The big increase in the religious unaffiliation. What I find is that things overall, in terms of membership, look pretty good, especially for evangelical Christians.
Mm-hmm. So we're not at the precipice, so to speak.
Not today.
Yeah.
And when you look at young people, when I did a cohort analysis by comparing this generation of young people to prior generations, they're doing fine. They're doing about the same as the previous generation.
So the kids are all right, so to speak.
Yeah. Exactly. But, that raises the question, why are we so worried about this particular generation? What's the mechanism that's going to drive them all from their faith?
Mm-hmm.
Because, look at the kids of the 60s. Now, that was a generation that should have lost Christianity for the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But now, they're the ones in their 50s and 60s who are writing books worrying about today's youth.
I mean, it's typical. I'm sure you could see that back in the 1930s and the 40s as well. We oftentimes forget that we often look back words and saying, oh, those moral degenerate kids and such. Let me ask about this change in the 1990s, and this comes up, as you mentioned, the General Social Survey, the GSS data, as well as the American Research or American Religion Identification Survey. You see this fairly big jump in unaffiliated individuals. Mm-hmm. And to what extent is this, and this might go beyond the bounds of what you're looking at your data, but as a sociologist, you feel free to speculate all you want, that there's been a trend toward non-denominational churches in the past 10 to 20 years or so. I mean, do you think any of that has to do with this?
It could be. Now, this, as you mentioned, is just, on my part, pure speculation.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be that people are sort of moving away from sort of standardized or traditional forms of Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a strong move would be to say, I still believe in God, I still believe in heaven and hell, but I'm not going to be religious.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a weaker move is to say, well, I'm no longer going to be Assembly of God or Evangelical Free or whatever other denomination. I'm now just going to go to whatever church works for me among Christian churches.
Yeah,
so that could be.
I'm wondering to what extent the surveys, our surveys tend to be reflections of what we've done in the past. And so our, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, we would ask questions along the lines of, are you a Presbyterian?
Mm-hmm.
And our notion of Christianity is some degree affiliation with a specific denomination. And to the extent that you're seeing the rise of more community churches, and I say this from my own vantage point as our church is possibly in the process of disaffiliating with a denomination, is mm-hmm. that, if somebody asked me, well, are you a Methodist? And I would say, well, no. And, you know, does that mean I'm unaffiliated? You know, what does that mean? I'm wondering to what extent we're picking that up in the data.
Yeah, that could well be. Mm-hmm. That could well be. And in my own life, I was raised Catholic. Then I got involved in an evangelical church. Then I went to a charismatic church. And then I was in an Episcopalian church for a while. Now I'm back into a community church.
Now you've done the whole circuit riding, I guess,
yeah.
So to speak, the denominational circuit riding. So I have to ask, you know, in terms of stereotypes, then, do you have big hair?
You know, I'm getting to the point where I wish I had big hair. I'm worried about losing my hair. but at least as of today, I have short hair.
Okay. You
know, I think long hair is cool.
Uh-huh.
I tried growing my hair out long a couple years ago, and I cut it when my pastor told me I looked like Nick Nolte. Nick Nolte's mugshot. I don't know if you remember that from a couple years
ago.
Yeah,
well, he was arrested for DUI or something.
Yeah, but it was not flattering. And then a colleague at school, I hadn't seen him for a couple months. He walked by, he looked at me, he said, and just in passing, he said, you look like hell, get your hair cut. And just started walking. So I thought, okay, time to cut it.
Okay. Let me ask you, in terms of your research and doing this book, I mean, it must have been a fairly fun project to do this. I mean, it's really reflected in the writing that you have. It's, you know, for those of you who are listening to this podcast, I recommend that you go out and buy this book because it's written in a way that is both, you know, scholarly, it's both rigorous in a scholarly sense, but also it's very enjoyable to read. What was one of the most interesting things that you found in the process of writing this?
How many people are interested in these topics that I thought only scholars would be interested in?
Mm-hmm.
So that's interested me. I also enjoy it a lot. I like the idea of maybe reaching people who don't read, mm-hmm. who aren't my fellow scholars. On the downside, this type of work has a time pressure with it that academic publishing doesn't.
Right.
And so I had a deadline, and I spent 6 months writing most of every day to meet it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I found surprising is that among academics, some people like it, but I have had some people who are in a place to evaluate my work say, well, that doesn't count as research because it's not a university press.
Yeah.
And so, you know, is it, my biggest concern is that scholars will think it's popular and popular people will think it's scholarship.
Hmm. Well, that is you know, an interesting thing that I've been wrestling with too. And as we noted earlier, part of this podcast is to really make scholarly research relevant to the general population. I mean, that should be part of our mission. Much as, you know, medical doctors have the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm, we should have an oath that says, you know, educate more individuals. And
I agree.
You know, now I'm, you know, mid-career individual. You know, often thinking about these issues that, you know, I publish another article and how many people read that, 5 or 6 people within, you know, my specific mm-hmm. circle. And the big question becomes, you know, to what extent can we get people interested in this? And I have found through, you know, starting this podcast and some of my own writing and you know, the works of many other people that I've run across, Rodney Stark and such, have just been, you know, people want to hear this stuff. But if we keep it cloistered in, you know, the American Sociological Review of Religion and Deviancy in the 1930s journal, you know, that you know, what are we doing this for, I guess?
Yes, but those are where the professional rewards are.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So what you're doing with the podcast is what I'm doing with the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're sort of stepping outside a little bit. And, you know, we'll see how it plays. But I agree with you completely that it's, at least for me, it's much more satisfying to reach you know, beyond the dozens of people who would otherwise read my work.
Mm-hmm. Now, this book is, and again, we are recording this on July 5th, 2010, and when we actually put this up on the website, might be about a month from now as we start to move forward in the early parts of this podcast. I'm trying to build a backlog here just to make sure that we always have something coming new. But so your book has been out, you know, a few weeks now, I would guess.
Mm-hmm. No, and it came out July 1st. So
came out July 1st.
A few weeks by the time that you put this up online.
Okay, because what I was going to ask you, you know, what kind of reception have you gotten from the general public on this work, if any? I mean, have you heard anything back yet? Or?
Well, I've done 4 or 5 radio interviews,
mm-hmm.
and then I've had some people write me,
mm-hmm.
and and overall, it's positive. Mm-hmm. People are like I said, more interested in these topics than I probably would have thought they would be.
Mm-hmm.
So just like Freakonomics found a big audience for sort of pop economics.
Right.
I think there's also a market for pop research on religion. Hopefully it's big, but I can't imagine it would be. But
I think we might surprise ourselves. I mean, this is what we're betting on here with the podcast, is that, I mean, there are millions and millions of Christians who are out there, and, you know, again, the stereotype says that they all have big hair and they're the only thing that they read is their Bible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as I've found in talking with other people saying, hey, I'm doing this podcast, they say, oh, really? You know, tell me where this is. I got to tell a friend about this. And mm-hmm. I think they're interested in finding out things, you know, especially for the Christian community, finding out things about themselves other than, you know, the cloistered view of their own Sunday services that they get from one another. So.
Yeah, I think you're right, and perhaps even more so. I hope that you're right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we hope that is the case. One last question here is, you know, and I didn't get at this question very much, but, you know, your book deals with a lot of these stereotypes, and mm-hmm. The stereotypes that we talk about in the media, and so you're not only talking about reports in the news media, but also this deals with Hollywood images in movies and on television, and even Christian intellectuals oftentimes put forth a number of these different stereotypes. What do you think motivates this? What's your thoughts on that?
I'm so glad you asked about that, Tony. I was actually trying to figure out a way of working that into the conversation. That was a big surprise for me getting into this book, and that is that a lot of the bad news we hear about Christianity is from our Christian leaders and teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell it to us with the very best of intentions. So let's say this. Let's say that a pastor at a church comes up with a new sermon series about, I don't know, giving money, tithing.
Mm-hmm.
How's he going to get people interested in it? Well, he'll say, you are not tithing.
Right.
You're doing a bad job, so you have to listen to my series.
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say an organization has a conference for training youth leaders to be more effective. How are they going to promote it? They're going to say, the youth of today are falling away. You need our conference.
Right.
And so it's almost like if we had a home security company where we sold alarms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our commercials would show burglars breaking into houses to scare mm-hmm. people to get our alarms. And so even though we're trying to make people feel safe with our alarms, we're trying to scare them to make them want to feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that same principle, which has been articulated by Barry Glassner and Joel Best and other people in other aspects of society, comes to play in religion. That it's in the motivation, and it's profitable, both financially and spiritually, I suppose, for Christian leaders and teachers to highlight the negative
mm-hmm.
about Christians. And so we hear it from the media, we hear it from our leaders and teachers. Well, no wonder we believe it.
Yeah. Hey, crisis sells, crisis motivates. And
exactly.
One of the nice things about your book, though, is that even though we hear these crisis alarm bells quite often,
mm-hmm.
which does tend to motivate you, and I think about your, you know, what you just said about tithing. If my pastor came up and said, wow, we're really flush with cash this month, I would say, well, you know what? I was, you know, thinking about taking the family to the Four Seasons for dinner tonight, so I think I'll do that instead. I appreciate that in some regards, because these call for actions, you need to be motivated somehow. But I think what your book does so nicely is to remind us of the other side of the story. And so if mm-hmm. if we get so wound up with all the crisis talk and the doomsaying, it's nice to know that, you know, things are actually going pretty well out there, and we need to keep that in mind as well. Always, you know, working forward to solve social problems and other issues, but also realizing the progress that we have made over the many decades here as Christians and as social scientists as well.
Mm-hmm. And there's actually another downside to that constant negative messages,
mm-hmm.
and that is that as Christians, we're to reach out to others.
Mm-hmm.
And we're to advance the Christian sort of agenda, both in our actions and our words. But why in the world would we want to do it if the church and its people are absolutely failing?
That is a good point.
And so you end up with an irony that the teachers are basically saying, the church is going to die tomorrow, its people are complete hypocrites, so go out and invite people to join us.
Yeah, I guess that's not something that really sells very well. Anyways, well, Brad, I want to thank you for joining us here on Research on Religion. I wish you the best for your book. It is, again, for those of you who are listening, it is a really, really good read. You'll learn a lot of things that surprise you. Would even touch the surface on a number of the myths and stereotypes that are there. And I did that intentionally because you need to go out and buy Brad's book so that he can actually, so it sends a signal to the rest of academia that, you know, success can come in many different forms. And so, again, Brad, I wish you all the best on your work, and thank you for visiting us on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, Tony. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.